Radioactive tritium. That's what's in the 1.3 million tons of wastewater from Fukushima Daiichi that Japan began dumping into the Pacific Ocean last Thursday, August 24, 2023. Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, deny there's anything wrong with what they're doing, and the media is becoming saturated with well-placed denials of the dangers, poo-pooing concerns by everyone from their fishing industry to nations. Like the tobacco industry, the nuclear industry has a full array of shills, propagandists, and skewed research. But there are still some genuine experts outside of their control. Scientists, researchers, academics, activists, who understand what is really going on, the dangers of those radioactive water releases. And then one of them tells you,
you know, the proposal is that essentially it disappears once it's got the chance to mix in properly, say with an ocean's worth of seawater. They ignore the issue of the organically bound tritium, whereby it may have dissolved, so it's reduced from the content of the radioactive discharge from the nuclear power station. When it's discharged, you can measure it, and it's at 10 becquerels to the liter off the end of the pipeline. And the further away you get in the seawater, it's lower and lower. But if you start to look at tritium in the shellfish and the seabirds that are eating the shellfish, then you realize that no, it's not dissolving and disappearing. There are methods by which it can reconcentrate, get into the food chain. For a country like Japan, which eats a lot of fish, it eats a lot of shellfish, and not only that, but they're doing aquaculture and eating seaweed as well. This is all a big deal.
It is. And when marine biologist Tim Deere Jones, along with Dr. Ian Fairley and Dr. Christopher Busby, are among the dozens of genuine, credentialed, published, and peer-reviewed experts, are all raising a red flag on the nuclear industry's manipulation of public understanding to cover up the damning nature and legacy of the actions Japan started last week? You see how the heat is ramping up for all of us under that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. Wrong, wrong. This week, as Japan continues to dump radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, we look at the truth about tritium. We revisit excerpts from Nuclear Hot Seat interviews with marine biologist Tim Deere Jones and Dr. Ian Fairley, an independent consultant on radioactivity in the environment. We also cite recent writings on tritium by Dr. Chris Busby, a British scientist primarily studying the health effects of internal ionizing radiation. If you're inclined to think that tritium is a weak sister in the family of radionuclides and not of any concern to people or the environment, you will want to hear what they have to say. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been put on the schedule for the Strike Force 5 podcast, which features as co-hosts late-night comedy experts Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, and Jimmy Kimmel. Well, they may not have nuclear on the schedule yet, but we're working on it. And all of that will be coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 29, 2023. And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., starting with some terrific news. A U.S. appeals court on Friday, August 25th, canceled a license granted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for the company Interim Storage Partners to build a so-called interim nuclear waste storage facility in West Texas. The license, issued in 2021, was challenged by the state of Texas as well as West Texas oil and gas interests and, of course, activists. U.S. Circuit Court Judge James Ho, writing for the court, said the Atomic Energy Act does not give the agency the broad authority, quote, to license a private, away-from-reactor storage facility for spent nuclear fuel. We will have an interview with Karen Haddon of the SEED Coalition, which fought against this storage site, coming up in 2 weeks. More good news comes from Illinois, where Governor Pritzker recently vetoed SB 76, the proposed repeal of Illinois' nuclear construction moratorium. And in 2 weeks, we will also have Dave Kraft of Nuclear Energy Information Service, based in Chicago, to talk about that stunning decision. But in California, unfortunately, Friends of the Earth sued in state superior court, hoping to derail a state-backed proposal to keep the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors running for at least 5 additional years. But last Thursday, a California judge rejected the environmental group's lawsuit, leading Friends of the Earth to state that they might appeal. And in Massachusetts, while Holtec, the company decommissioning the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, was blocked from releasing radioactive water from spent fuel pools into Cape Cod Bay, a whistleblower has reported that the company is already releasing some of that water into the air in the form of gaseous effluent, in other words, steam. In the whistleblower's letter to both the State Department of Public Health and Diane Turco, director of Cape Downwinders, an advocacy group, they said Holtec plans to, quote, boil away the water volume and take no responsibility for putting dangerous radionuclides into the environment. The company's priority is profit. We are acceptable collateral damage. We all know by now that Japan has started dumping tritium-contaminated radioactive water from Fukushima Daiichi into the Pacific Ocean, and that has unleashed the world's wrath. Last Saturday, 50,000 Korean people gathered in Seoul to condemn Japan's discharge of this water. China has banned all imports of Japanese seafood. Condemnation continues, and there are demonstrations already planned for Seoul, Fiji, Sydney, Manila, New Delhi, Berlin, New York, Los Angeles, Honolulu, the Philippines, Suva, and Zurich, and these are just the places that we know of. One Japanese demonstrator said, "It's like dumping an atomic bomb in the ocean. Japan is the first and only country that was attacked with an atomic bomb in the world, and the prime minister of the country made this decision." On Monday, Prime Minister Kishida urged China to rein in harassing calls over the Fukushima water release, saying there have been numerous harassing phone calls thought to have originated in China and instances of stones being thrown at the Japanese embassy and Japanese schools, and, quote, strongly urged China's ambassador to call on Chinese people to act calmly and responsibly. Would that Japan would act calmly and responsibly. Russia hopes to take advantage of the situation by increasing its marine production exports to China in the wake of China's ban on Japanese seafood imports. Russia is one of the biggest marine product suppliers to China. Meanwhile, Japan has been considering a rescue plan for its domestic fisheries after China's ban on fish imports. Japan's seafood exports to China stood at 160 billion yen, or $1 billion in 2022, some 40% of total outbound shipments in value. No word on how the government plans to mitigate that. In Ukraine, on August 25th, the 6-reactor Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station, the largest in Europe, lost all off-site power, and all 6 reactors were shut down for the first time in history. Diesel backup generators did kick in, and the power was later restored. The head of Ukraine's nuclear agency said, "Diesel is just the last defense. This is one step from the emergency radiation." The shelling by Russia in recent days around Zaporizhia landed close to two of the facility's nuclear reactor buildings. This according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA. Note that if power is lost again, diesel generators can operate for 10 days of cooling if they are working, and if the diesel generators are down or run out of fuel, there could be the start of a meltdown situation within an hour and a half of them going down. Now, here's the first of two interviews. The nuclear industry is fond of treating radioactive tritium as some kind of benign radionuclide. Oh, it's not dangerous, nothing to get your knickers in a twist about. That's in order to dump massive quantities of tritium-contaminated water into our oceans without the level of pushback that this heinous action deserves. The narrative could not be more wrong. So to build understanding, I've revisited two important interviews, both dealing with tritium, and edited together the important bits to give you some concentrated clarity. First, Dr. Ian Fairley. He is a London-based radiation biologist and independent consultant on radioactivity in the environment. He has been consultant on radiation matters to the European Parliament, local and regional governments, environmental NGOs, and private individuals, with a focus on the radiation doses and risks arising from the radioactive releases at nuclear facilities. At the time we talked, Japan's decision to dump tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean had been announced, but response to this move was still muted, in the assumption that we had time and that cooler heads would mitigate the action. As we now know, it hasn't. Also, decision had not yet been made in Massachusetts about dumping radioactive spent fuel pool water from the shut-down Pilgrim nuclear facility to dump radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay, meaning the Atlantic Ocean. But as of July 24, 2023, Massachusetts has banned decommissioning company Holtec from taking that action. So when Ian and I discussed the Pilgrim information, know that that situation was live at the time, but for now, it has been settled on the side of sanity. I spoke with Dr. Ian Fairley on Thursday, June 16, 2022. Dr. Ian Fairley is a London-based radiation biologist and independent consultant on radioactivity in the environment. He has been a consultant on radiation matters to the European Parliament, local and regional governments, environmental NGOs, and private individuals, with a focus on the radiation doses and risks arising from radioactive releases at nuclear facilities. We spoke on Thursday, June 16, 2022. Dr. Ian Fairley, welcome back to Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure, Libby.
Let's give people a brief rundown on your background and the focus of your work, your field of expertise.
Well, I'm a radiation biologist by training and university degrees, but my focus has been on radioactive waste, and in particular, tritium, the most common radioisotope in the world, and its dangers. It's been a sort of a lifelong hobby in many ways. In answer to your question, what am I? I see myself as a citizen scientist, somebody who tries hard to explain to the public radiation and radioactivity are not the easiest things in the world to grasp, certainly at first sight. And my main purpose is to try and help people overcome their fear about radiation and radioactivity and help them understand it a bit.
When you do your work, which has been extensive and worldwide, who hires you and what do they hire you to work on?
Well, they hire me mainly to make estimates of radiation doses and risk as a result of planned discharges. I'm hired to comment on government reports, in particular to identify areas where the reports have been less than accurate, not quite correct, scientifically speaking. In other words, to provide a critique to official sources of information. That's basically what I'm about.
Let's take a moment here before we return to more on those findings, to explore what is tritium and why is it so dangerous?
Tritium is the radioactive isotope of hydrogen. Its most common form is in tritiated water. I'm pretty sure that your listeners will be aware that water consists of H2O, two hydrogen atoms stuck onto an oxygen atom. The thing is that one of those hydrogen atoms is radioactive. That's tritiated water. You can't separate tritiated water from ordinary water. They're both water. Isotopically, they are slightly different, but you can't really separate them at all. It's very, very difficult. And the thing is that when very large amounts of tritiated water are discharged both to the sea or to the air in terms of water vapor from all nuclear facilities. Now, why is this dangerous? Well, the reason why is because human beings are mostly water. Two-thirds of our body weight is water molecules. So if you're talking about a contaminated environment, we as human beings are in the firing line, and it should be a worry to all people who live near nuclear facilities. Should be. The problem is that when you have a nuclear facility like Point Lepreau putting out very large amounts of tritium, terabecquerels, that's trillions of becquerels of radioactivity. What's a becquerel? One disintegration per second. So you have humongous amounts being shoved out every year. And the thing is that people downwind breathe it in. Because it contaminates food grown locally, they eat it. And because it contaminates the water supply nearby, they drink it. So there are three different ways, in fact, four different ways that people can get it. The fourth way is by skin absorption. Now, with other radionuclides, that doesn't happen. Why does it happen with tritium? Because it's water. And our body avidly takes up water. So your next question will be, is this a worry? I mean, are there any risks? I mean, what do we find? Well, we find that if you look at epidemiological studies of people near nuclear facilities, they all show increased incidences of cancers, leukemias, lymphomas, and also of birth defects, which is precisely what we would expect to see if tritium were affecting the DNA of people who live downwind of a reactor. We see it. The trouble is that the people who conduct these epidemiological studies, they fiddle the results. I'm afraid that these scientists are hired by the nuclear industry, and the nuclear industry do not want to have results which show, whoa, these results show increased incidences. So what they do is they say, the results are not statistically significant. And they throw it into a waste bin. Throw the results into a waste bin. Well, that's wrong. You don't do that. What you do is you try and get lump studies together so you can get statistical significance. But they don't do that. We'll do this little study here. No, we don't find it. It's not statistically significant. This is the misuse of statistical tests. But the trouble is, I'm talking about things which most of your listeners will find difficult to grasp. This is a scientific argument amongst statisticians. All I can say is that when you look at big studies, put together a bunch of small studies, you do attain statistical significance of whatever. There are genuine increases there. Maybe if I can give you a little analogy to explain why statistical significance is important. Say you have a coin, you think that it's been doctored, so that if you flip the coin 10 times, instead of getting 5 heads and 5 tails, you get 6 heads and 4 tails. Is that a meaningful result? It's hard to tell. Maybe not. Flip the coin 20 times and you get 11 heads and 9 tails. Is that significant? How about 15 heads and 5 tails? Yes, that is significant. So do you see what I'm getting at? The bigger the difference from what you would expect, you get significance. And the best way is to do take 100 flips of the coin. And if you get something like 60 heads and 40 tails, hey, that's significant, all right. The coin's bent, okay? I'm going to leave it there. And I'm just trying to give you an idea of what happens when you do these epidemiological studies. The trouble is that the researchers who do it make false conclusions. You speak with forked tongue. By the way, the worst culprits of statistical testing were, guess who? The tobacco companies. Back in the 60s and 70s, they would do little studies here and little studies there. No, there isn't an increased level of cancers. Well, there is a little increase, but it's not statistically significant.
So when tritium is characterized as a so-called low-risk radionuclide, how accurate is that?
Inaccurate. It's wrong. There have been quite a few study reports showing that tritium has got a high RBE. What does that mean? It means relative biological effectiveness. Relative to what? Relative to X-rays. This is radiobiology 101, by the way. Basically, if you were to look at a lot of radiation, X-rays, gamma rays, they have a relative biological effectiveness of about one. Basically, tritium is about 2 to 3 times more effective than X-rays and gamma rays.
And when you say effective, you mean impactful on the body?
Yeah. When people say effectiveness, they mean dangerous. It's a nice word for it that scientists, like ICRP people, say, it's more effective. Yeah, i.e., it bloody well kills you. So, in comparison with other forms of radiation, tritium is actually more dangerous, more hazardous. Okay, that's point one. And another thing is that when people in the nuclear industry say that tritium isn't dangerous, what they mean is that outside the body, it isn't dangerous. But they don't talk about what happens when it gets inside the body. There is a real problem here, because when tritium gets inside you, we don't really know where it goes. For example, does it go to your liver, your kidneys, your brain, what? Well, the real answer is it goes everywhere. It gets into every cell where there's water. Wherever there's water, tritium goes, okay? And that means that if the tritium happens to land next door to a DNA molecule, it's very dangerous indeed. Now, what the nuclear industry and ICRP say, we're just average over the whole body. Well, you can't do that. And there's a form of tritium called organically bound tritium, which doesn't just go over the whole body. It sticks to carbohydrates, proteins and lipids inside us and stays inside us for a long time. Stops being tritiated water and now becomes organically bound tritium. What is it bound to? It's bound to carbon atoms. That's why it's called organically bound tritium. And that stays in the body for a long time. That is far more dangerous than tritiated water. But that's what happens. When you take in tritiated water, some of it gets bound up into organically bound tritium. And has the nuclear industry got a handle on that? Not in the least. The thing about it is that there's a great deal of uncertainty about what actually happens to when we are exposed to tritium. Now, that should be tinkle warning bell, ding, 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 ding. We should be applying the precautionary principle.
And what is the precautionary principle?
Precautionary principle, said very briefly, is err on the side of caution. If there's evidence which suggests that something could be dangerous, act on that evidence, even though it might not be complete. Basically, what you're saying is that you're going to err on the side of safety, basically it. Of course, the nuclear industry doesn't like that at all. They would much rather that we erred on the side of danger. And that's exactly what they do. I've been pressing for a long time that we should be going for the precautionary principle. It's been enshrined in United Nations conventions. I have to say, Libby, that it's more honoured in the breach than in the observance. Basically, it means that a lot of lip service is given to it, but it's never really taken into account. We should, but we don't.
Currently, there are right now two cases where citizens are fighting back against planned releases of tritium-contaminated nuclear reactor water into the ocean. The first is by Tokyo Electric Power Company at Fukushima in Japan, where at this point they have something like 1.5 million tons of water from that accident in tanks that Japan next year is planning to just dump into the Pacific. And also in Massachusetts, Holtec, which is decommissioning the Pilgrim Station in Massachusetts, is planning to dump their store of spent fuel pool water, which also contains tritium, into Cape Cod Bay, meaning the Atlantic Ocean. Thus far, these are being treated as two separate stories. But is there any substantive difference between planned releases of tritiated water in these two areas other than the ocean that it would be going into?
No, they're both the same. Tritium is tritium. The main thing that I would look at is at the concentrations of tritium. In the two cases, I don't know what the concentration will be at Pilgrim. I do know the concentration at Fukushima is 1 million becquerels per liter in the tanks, although they plan to dilute this down to 100,000. And that's still very, very high. Strongly recommend that this doesn't occur. And if I was asked a question about what should the Japanese authorities do, they should build more tanks. And if that costs a lot of money, well, so be it. Safety first.
Precautionary principle.
Dr. Ian Fairley. He is a London-based radiation biologist and independent consultant on radioactivity in the environment. We will have a link up to his website, ianfairley.org. We will also link to Nuclear Hot Seat number 574, which has this full interview on it. And Ian has prepared a primer on radiation and radioactivity for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We have a downloadable PDF of that book available on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 636. We'll have the second part of our update on tritium with marine biologist Tim Deere Jones in just a moment. But first, whenever the nuclear industry wants to get away with something, they have a massive media machine to make certain their talking points are the dominant ones. There are soul-dead cubicle drones who write propaganda press releases and print-ready stories for World Nuclear News, favored reporters and talk show hosts who spread the word, manufactured op-eds, and an international reach backed by millions upon millions of dollars. That's for placing their perspective anywhere and everywhere they want. Those who know the genuine facts and oppose nuclear outrages like what's happening in Japan right now have a tough, almost vertical uphill climb to get our perspective in front of the public. That's why now more than ever, you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We're dedicated to presenting you with expert interviews that contradict nuclear industry propaganda talking points. We cover not only what the industry is doing, but how brave activists around the world are fighting back. And how any one of us can join in taking action towards stopping the nuclear madness. But in order to keep doing this show, we need your help. I can't emphasize this enough. Without your donations, we don't have the money to pay the bills. So if you want Nuclear Hot Seat to keep going, we need your support now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button. You can send a one-time donation of any amount or set up a recurring donation. $5 a month, same as a cup of coffee. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, which means your donations are tax deductible. So take action right now. Hit the pause button, then go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send the donation directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please do not wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now, and then listen to the rest of the program. Whatever you can do to help, you have my gratitude. Now here's this week's second featured interview. Tim Deere Jones is an internationally renowned marine biologist, a researcher and consultant who specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. We've had him on the show many times before, the reason being that he's thorough, articulate, and gives us plenty to think about. Recently, we had an extended conversation about tritium dangers. At that time, the decision had not yet been made in Massachusetts to ban Holtec's plans to dump tritium-contaminated water from the Pilgrim nuclear reactor into Cape Cod Bay and from Indian Point into the Hudson River. Both of those have been blocked, but you will hear them referred to. To learn more about what tritium is, how it behaves in water, and the true nature of what we will face if these corporate water dumps take place, and one has already started, I know of no one better to ask than Tim Deer Jones. We spoke on Saturday, March 18, 2023. It's important for us to understand, what are we facing here? Let's start with the basics. What is tritium?
Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. And because we're talking about tritium in the sea, it's important to remember that hydrogen is an important component of water, H2O, and there are natural forms of tritium, and there's an awful lot of man-made tritium now on the planet since the 1940s.
How long does tritium remain radioactive?
Okay, well, tritium has a half-life of 12.3 years, or thereabouts, in its normal form in tritiated water or tritium-contaminated water. Most people agree, I think, that you need to go through 10 half-lives before any of your radioactive constituents, whatever they may be, are rendered sort of pretty harmless. So in the case of tritium, we're talking about 123 years.
You mentioned natural and, I would assume, unnatural, meaning man-made tritium. Explain the difference between the two and where they come from.
It is perfectly correct to say that we do have natural tritium. The enormous bulk of it is produced in the upper atmosphere as a result of solar radioactivity interactions between atmospheric hydrogen and the solar radioactivity. That produces, and I will give you one number here, that produces 10 to the 16, so that's 10 with 16 noughts after it, becquerels of tritium a year, most of which falls down to the planetary surface, falls into the water. If it falls onto the land, it ends up being washed into the water or incorporated into plant life. On the other hand, if you look at the human production of tritium, it's very rapidly proves itself to be much, much, much more significant than the amount of tritium which is produced by natural sources. For instance, atmospheric weapons testing produced about 10,000 times the amount of tritium that is produced naturally a year.
Meaning still the leftover materials from weapons testing is still producing.
Yeah, because we haven't lost the half-lives yet. You know, you think you've got to go through your 123 years before the material you've produced has sort of worked itself down to a state where it does nothing and causes no damage and its radioactivity content is very low. So we haven't got to that stage. And meanwhile, we have been generating more and more as a result of sea dumping, which was stopped in the 1980s, but an awful lot of radioactive tritium was thrown overboard, shipped into the sea. And meanwhile, again, ever since then, we've had a lot of nuclear activity, nuclear power stations, nuclear generators, fuel processing, nuclear fuel production, experiments with fission, as well as fusion. And all of these produce large amounts of tritium, most of which now ends up into the aquatic systems because it was understood quite early on that discharges of tritiated water as tritium in steam to the atmosphere was causing health problems to populations. This was way back in Kennedy's era when the first weapons test ban treaties were worked on. That was one of the problems that they were worried about then. But since then, the atmospheric testing has stopped. But the civil nuclear process is going on, and pretty much everything that we do in the nuclear industry produces tritium, which is either discharged to atmosphere or discharged to water.
This is, of course, a major issue right now in Japan because of the tritiated water from Fukushima. Explain how humans become exposed to tritium. Where do they get it from and what does it do to them?
What you're talking about is kind of the end point of a lot of these sites. So the end point of the Fukushima disaster, the end point of the Pilgrim unit, because that's been closed down and they're now looking to get rid of their final waste out of that site. But don't forget that all your other boiling water reactors, pressurized water reactors, are continually discharging large amounts of tritium into the atmospheric and the marine environment with a bias towards the marine environment. So my area of interest has been the impact of marine discharges of tritium. And what we see is that tritium has been considered in the past, because it's what they define, the nuclear industry define, as a weak beta emitter. Now, beta emissions are shortwave and not very strong. So, for instance, they don't necessarily penetrate the skin like a gamma or an X-ray would. And so for that reason, they're considered to be relatively harmless. But one of the big problems that has surfaced sort of in the late 1990s, and the work on it has grown subsequently, is the understanding that actually tritium in watercourses quickly becomes absorbed into protein materials and organic materials. So it'll absorb onto proteins, it'll absorb onto organic materials, it'll absorb onto carbon materials, and it'll absorb onto things called lipids, which are kind of natural fats. And when that happens, we call it organically bound tritium. And that puts us into a completely different setup in regards of dosimetry.
When you talk about proteins and organic material that the tritium gets bound to, are you talking about fish and aquatic life and seaweed and minute organisms that then feed the rest of the ocean?
You got it, Libby. You got it. It's the microorganisms are the first port of call for your water-based tritium, because they are organic, because they have proteins, because they have lipids, and because a lot of them have carbon bases to them as well. So these little tiny things absorb all this stuff. And then, as you pointed out, everybody above them in the food chain starts to bioaccumulate and biomagnify as the little ones eat the small ones, and then the medium-sized ones eat the little ones, and then the big ones eat the medium-sized ones. And as you go up the food chain, you get enormous magnitude, so that in the Bristol Channel, which is an area that I've been doing desk and field research on for some decades now, this is UK waters, we find that while you may have a level of 10 becquerels to the litre in the seawater in the Bristol Channel, by the time you get to the top predators, or as far as you can go, or as far as the nuclear industry and the regulators have measured, you find you've got 36,000 becquerels. So you've got a huge biomagnification occurring up the food chain. Now, there has been no study on human beings in that kind of situation. The investigations of tritium impacts on humans have been for nuclear workers receiving massive doses either on the skin as a result of a nuclear accident on site. So we don't have these dietary studies, and we don't have them relating to human beings in the context of organically bound tritium. So there's a huge area of ignorance here about the health effects to human populations of organically bound tritium. But what you can see from looking at the wildlife is that biomagnification occurs. And there are studies which have been done on mammals, such as mice and rats and monkeys. And that finds that one of the things that tritium quite likes to involve itself with is RNA and DNA. Therefore, now you know that those two, RNA and DNA, help to code and produce and manage genetic sequences. So this is a very significant potential, which, as far as I can see, has not been thoroughly examined to date.
So it sounds like, certainly Japan being the prime example right now, but in other instances where tritiated water releases are being discussed, it's misdirection for them to say, okay, this is what it does in the water, because the bigger problem is how what's in the water gets absorbed into the life stream of plants and animals and then gets bioaccumulated up. So when Japan says we're just releasing X amount of tritium and it's not really a problem, they're not looking at the full problem. And I think there are some obvious political reasons for that. How does the nuclear industry, and I'm thinking specifically here of the International Atomic Energy Agency and also the International Commission on Radiological Protection, or ICRP, how do those major nuclear industry organizations deal with this information about tritium, or do they deal with it at all?
I think they skip over it. It's my interpretation of what I read. And of course, I'm an unorthodox as far as they're concerned. They have their orthodoxy, and their orthodoxy says that, as I've said earlier, you know, the tritium is a weak beta emitter, and they don't seem to be particularly interested in addressing this issue of organically bound tritium, which completely changes the whole, you know, it's a smoking gun, which is hidden behind the idea that tritium, it's natural, and it's a weak beta emitter, and we put it in the water, and it dissolves, and it'll keep dissolving. I've read statements saying that it dissolves into infinity. So, you know, the proposal is that essentially it disappears once it's got the chance to mix in properly, say with an ocean's worth of seawater. They ignore the issue of the organically bound tritium, whereby it may have dissolved so that in the Bristol Channel, as I said earlier, it's reduced from the content of the radioactive discharge from the nuclear power station. When it's discharged, you can measure it, and it's at 10 becquerels to the litre off the end of the pipeline. And the further away you get in the seawater, it's lower and lower. But if you start to look at tritium in the shellfish and the seabirds that are eating the shellfish, then you realise that, no, it's not dissolving and disappearing. There are methods by which it can reconcentrate, get into the food chain. For a country like Japan, which eats a lot of fish, it eats a lot of shellfish, and not only that, but they're doing aquaculture and eating seaweed as well. This is all a big deal.
What are the other delivery methods by which human beings can be contaminated by this tritium water? It's not just the fish in the water.
There's the digestion, the dietary route. But for me, equally significant is the inhalation route. Tritiated water behaves just like any other water. For instance, when atmospheric discharges of tritium from nuclear power stations are made, they are in the form of tritiated steam. So it's steam, condensed water, loaded with the tritium. So once the tritium is in the water, you can't remove it. Doesn't matter if it turns into steam or water vapor, it won't be removed. Now, we know from studies that have been conducted in the UK that the radionuclide cesium-137 dissolves in water. And there are studies from the UK and from numerous academics, but also early studies from the nuclear industry, who stopped those studies pretty quickly because they began to show unfortunate results as far as they were concerned. But those studies showed that cesium-137 dissolved in water would blow ashore across the shoreline in sea spray and micro droplets from marine aerosols. So this is like kind of fog kind of droplets, you know. And we know, I mean, I'm talking to you from Wales, and there are areas of the Welsh coast where studies have shown that sea to land transferred cesium has been found 10 miles inland on agricultural produce. So first of all, your dietary isn't just seafood. You can also get a dietary dose of sea to land transferring water dissolved materials. So that would include tritium, but tritium hasn't been studied. So I shall refer again to cesium. We know that you can get a dietary dose of cesium on terrestrial produce, but it's marine cesium. But you can find it on agricultural produce up to 10 miles inland. So that gives you a much broader critical contact group, or coastal critical group, as we call them in the UK, people who are most exposed by reason of their habitats and their diets and their lifestyles. a much bigger critical group of people who are in receipt of sea to land transfer doses. Now, if tritiated water behaves like any other water, then it follows logically and scientifically that it will behave in the same way as the cesium does. So my argument is, why has nobody looked at the sea to land transfer of tritium? Now, this doesn't just apply to tritiated water as a kind of a sea to land transferred water vapor from breaking waves or from the vast expanses of wet sediments which are exposed at low tide. Think of a beach. Think of some beaches which are very shallow can be. We've got beaches in the UK which are a mile wide at the low tide because they're very shallow, but they're wet. On a hot day, they're evaporating the water out of them. That water contains cesium and tritiated water. And if there's an onshore breeze, you'll be inhaling that. And it will also be dropping tritiated material out onto agricultural produce. But then it's not just that, because we know that this effect is actually larger and greater if organic material is blown ashore. And we know that there are microbes and microbiology in the marine environment and little tiny particles of dead seaweed and other organic material. And we know, because that stuff has been captured, blowing across the shoreline, it's been captured in muslin nets. And we know that that stuff is also blowing ashore as part of the sea to land transfer. So there's another dose pathway here, and that is the sea to land transfer. So if it's blowing ashore, you will be breathing it. And if it can reach 10 miles inland, as has been shown in the UK, then you will be 10 miles worth of people, if you like to think of it that way, maybe inhaling that stuff and getting it into their lungs, from which it passes into the bloodstream, from where it passes into the various body organs, brain, heart, you name it.
What do you consider will be the impact of this release?
Yeah, it's a desperate situation, isn't it? Because they are pushing forwards not only the industrial body in question, TEPCO, but they seem to have the support of everybody they need to have the support of. Don't worry about the public, but provided you've got your Japanese Nuclear Regulation Committee and the IAEA and people like that backing you, you're all right. But somebody is going to have to pick up the pieces. And I suppose the answer to that from the industry point of view is, if they can PR it well enough, they can cover it up, push it through, and then hush, hush any impacts that might occur. Now, I have seen these sort of situations occur in other scenarios. I've worked extensively on some major oil spills, and I've seen the oil companies come into a town where an oil spill has occurred, take it over and work a very good PR job and divide the community by turning some against the others and causing confusion. And I guess that's what the nuclear industry is going to do as this unfolds. But as far as the communities, let us say, in the Pacific or in Cape Cod are concerned, I think the potential is there for there to be a very significant economic impact. First of all, areas where nuclear industry is, I mean, in the UK, for instance, the Sellafield site. Sellafield used to be a tourist area. It's no longer a tourist area. So that's a relatively small site compared to the Pacific Ocean. But there's an example of what can happen. There was a local fishing industry at Sellafield. There isn't a local fishing industry there any longer. So if you've got prize agricultural products or prize marine food products, and then there is a threat of a radioactive pollution labelling of those products, then the market's going to fall off. So whether the nuclear industry can find allies enough and a persuasive advertising campaign to offset these things, I don't know. But I mean, we have seen in the UK islands where there was a very high cancer incidences, and that I can link to very high presence of sea to land transferring radioactivity. But from a campaigning point of view, those have been squashed and overwhelmed by nuclear industry PR. And I mean, you know, here in the UK now, as a campaigner, there are lots and lots of citizens groups who are very anxious about their local nuclear power stations and the more generalized impact of nuclear discharges to air and water. But they get no traction with government. They get no traction with the media because it seems that government and media are very susceptible to powerful lobbying and what we might call goody giving, if you can see what I mean, for journalists and government ministers and MPs to go and visit nuclear sites, be given a good dinner, perhaps be sent abroad to a conference that they don't have to attend, but they get to go abroad and say they were at the conference. These sort of things make it a lot easier for the nuclear industry to win the publicity battle.
Do you think that it's possible for the international pushback to have any impact on Japan's decision? And if so, what form would that have to take for Japan to sit up and go, oh, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
That's a very, very interesting and almost unanswerable question. I don't know what it'll take, because it seems to me that the history of the nuclear industry indicates that the nuclear industry itself, in the end, believes itself to be above and beyond public opinion and to be above and beyond public concerns. And it seems to be able to capture governments and regulatory agencies and media in a way which is not unprecedented, because we've seen the tobacco industry and the agricultural chemical industry do the same thing in the past. And they're really just following that same pattern. They can conjure up their own biased research. They can lean on people in all sorts of ways. They can rubbish people like you and me and those of us who are anxious and concerned. And I'm not really very hopeful in the current situation that Japan can be stopped. And therefore, we're going to have to get on the top of that. There needs to be a major effort, and I don't know where it's going to come from, except from citizens, to actually do something to try and observe and report the effects of what is happening at Fukushima. In the end, it's like a lot of things. It comes down to we the people and whether we can wake up enough of our respective national populations to what's happening so that we can swing it on a national basis.
That was UK-based marine biologist, researcher, and consultant Tim Deer Jones. The notes Tim provided to me for this interview were so extensive, at my request, he has agreed to allow me to make them available to you. The document is 11 pages of solid information and links to the footnotes in a downloadable PDF, just one click away. That will be listed on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 636. We will also have a link up to the original interview with Tim, which is much longer. That's Nuclear Hot Seat number 613. For a final word on tritium, Dr. Christopher Busby recently published a long article in counterpunch.org. He is scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk and the author of Uranium and Health, the Health Effects of Exposure to Uranium and Uranium Weapons Fallout. Chris is difficult to get on short notice, but he is such an uncompromising presence that I thought it important to include some of what he said in this week's show. In this August 25th, 2023 article, he wrote, "Tritium is very dangerous. It gets inside you easily. It exchanges with normal hydrogen. Sometimes it becomes organically bound. It causes genetic damage at tiny conventional doses. Those people living near the seaside, near the east coast of Japan, especially the estuaries, need to watch out. Don't eat anything from the sea or inside 1 kilometer from the coast. The radiation risk model that regulates tritium is obsolete and wildly incorrect. The experts that say there are no effects in populations living near tritium contamination need to look out the window." The words of Dr. Christopher Busby, and we will link to this article all on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode number 636.
Activists, shout out.
There was a press conference held on Monday, August 28th, on a flawed decision for Fukushima: scientific problems with the ALPS water treatment plant. It featured Arjun Makajani, who's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Shinichi Kurokawa, professor emeritus, High Energy Accelerator Research Organization, KEK, and Junichi Nukushina, representative of Civil Forum on Nuclear Radiation Damages of Japan. It was, of course, videotaped, and we have a link up to that video on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 636. If you're taking an action to demonstrate against the Japan water release, Actions Worldwide wants to know. We will have a link to register your action, such as rallies, online hashtag you're using, film screenings, press releases, or whatever. That will be clickable on the website. And for those of you who really want to understand what radiation is all about, remember that Mary Olson of Gender and Radiation Impact Project and Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear are teaching a series of 5 classes called Radiation Information for Everyone, or RIFE. It starts next week, September 5th, over Zoom. And I know that I, for one, will be in that class and on those calls. You can be too. Go to genderandradiation.org, spell out the and, A-N-D, genderandradiation.org. Click on the tab for classes and sign up. We all need to know as much as we can about radiation because, let's face it, it's never going away. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 29, 2023. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week so you never miss a single episode, we make it so easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and whammo, up pops a yellow opt-in box for you to fill out. Just put in your first name and email address, and every week we will send you one, just one email, that contains the link to the recording of the show and a short description of that show's content. If you prefer, you can just go to your favorite podcast channel and sign up there, because Nuclear Hot Seat is everywhere. But if you do it this way through the opt-in box, then you're on my database and Google likes me a lot more than they would otherwise. So, a podcaster out. Ya know? Now, wherever you are on the front lines of nuclear issues that I am not on the front line of, so I rely on you. If you see something going on and have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all will be greatly appreciated because your support means the world to us. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, the website, the names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevy of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, this is a quote, "Nuclear industry science is cartoon science, based on nonsense, and supported by twisted epidemiology. It is now dead in the water, but not before it has historically killed hundreds of millions of people." Dr. Chris Busby. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. We give you a new one every week. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.